This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In 1968, writer Hampton Sides was a six-year-old boy in Memphis when Martin Luther King was assassinated there. Sides says he remembers the anger and tension among adults at the time and images of tanks in the streets to quell civil unrest. Four decades later, Sides has returned to the subject of King's assassination. He's written a gripping account of King's murder and the hunt for his confessed assassin, James Earl Ray. Sides carefully reconstructs the movements and activities of James Earl Ray in the months before the assassination, intercut with the story of King, the man Ray was stalking. Hampton Sides is an editor-at-large for Outside Magazine and the author of the historical books Ghost Soldiers and Blood and Thunder. He spoke to Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies about his book Hellhound on His Trail, The Stalking of Martin Luther King Jr. and the International Hunt for His Assassin.
Well, Hampton Sides, welcome back to Fresh Air. The book opens with James Earl Ray in a prison in Missouri, where he escapes, climbs into a bread truck and makes it out of there. Tell us a little bit about who he was. This was in 1967, I guess about a year before the assassination. Who was this guy?
Well, James Earl Ray was a career criminal. He had grown up along the Mississippi River in a succession of impoverished towns. He came from a very dysfunctional family of mostly felons. His father was quite poor and changed his name, changed the family name repeatedly, Raines, Ryan, and various permutations of the name. So some of the Rays growing up didn't know their last name until they were adults. And, of course, Ray, as a criminal, spent most of his time coming up with aliases. He had a whole succession of them. As the story progresses, he becomes Eric Galt, Harvey Lohmeyer, John Willard, Ramon Snade, Paul Bridgman, all these different names. So, you know, this was one of his this was his stock in trade, really, coming up with these various identities.
So he manages to slip out of this prison in Jefferson City, Missouri, buried among loaves in a bread truck, gets away, and makes his way eventually to Mexico, Puerto Vallarta, and then after that goes to California under the alias of Eric Galt. And it's sort of, you know, he fits the description of a drifter as we see him in this period, but he also seems to have ambition. Tell us about some of the steps he took to acquire vocational skills and other kind of self-improvement schemes.
Well, he's doing some very unusual things out there in Los Angeles. He's decided at one point that he wants to become a porn director and buys a bunch of film equipment. He's also gets into bartending. He graduates from a bartending school. He's taking a correspondence course in locksmithing, and he's taking dancing lessons at a dance school to learn the cha-cha and the foxtrot and various other steps. He's getting deep into various self-help books, including this one in particular called Psycho Cybernetics. Hypnosis is one of his things. He gets a nose job just 1 month before the assassination. So, you know, what does all this all add up to? I mean, it's a very curious combination of interests. But, you know, the thing that kind of galvanizes him in late 1967 and early 1968 is the George Wallace for President campaign. He becomes a volunteer. He's quite interested in doing whatever he can to help Wallace get on the ballot in California. And I think that that's what begins to kind of give some coherence to all of these rather desperate and kind of eclectic interests that he has out there in Los Angeles.
Now, Wallace, of course, was an ultra-conservative populist and had a history, of course, of opposing integration. What do we know of James Earl Ray's racial attitudes?
Well, he was a racist. He had talked in prison about how killing King would be a retirement plan for him. He was into the John Birch Society. He was also quite interested in Rhodesia, which was the breakaway state in southern Africa, now Zimbabwe, that was run by Ian Smith. And he had inquired about how he might immigrate there.
And it was essentially an apartheid state, right?
It was. Right. It was a segregationist, rogue state that had no extradition treaty with the U.S.
You said that he might have said in prison that killing Martin Luther King would be his retirement plan? Meaning what?
Meaning that he would connect with bounties that he'd heard about. In prison, there was a number of rumors going around of Southern businessmen's associations and white citizens' councils who were floating bounties on King's head. And he thought, well, this is a possible business scheme for me. He also considered himself an aficionado of the JFK assassination and kind of studied it and analyzed it and tried to figure out what mistakes Oswald had made and, you know, became, I guess, got this idea that he, you know, might have been able to do it better.
Now, in the year that you document Ray's movements leading up to the assassination of King, you know, I don't recall seeing much of anything that in the way of real human relationships or friendships beyond, you know, I guess some regular contact he had with Mexican prostitutes. Was this the behavior of somebody keeping to himself because he's on the lam from the law, or did he have trouble connecting with people?
He had a lot of trouble connecting with people. And in fact, a lot of the books that he was reading, these self-help books, were books that were basically urging people, you know, giving advice about how you can make friends and how you can find happiness and find meaning and purpose in your life. And, you know, you get that sense throughout his period in Los Angeles that he is desperately trying to find some sort of purpose and desperately trying to find some happiness. The dancing school business, you know, it's the people there at the dancing school said he's the kind of person who needed to learn how to dance. He needed to connect. He needed some sort of human connection. Almost his whole life he had been a loner and had very few friends and very few people that he trusted. And I think that that's a part of his personality that carries through to the very end of his life.
At what point in James Earl Ray's wanderings does he appear to be stalking Martin Luther King?
It becomes much clearer that he's following King around March 18th. He's living in Los Angeles in a cheap hotel when Martin Luther King comes to Los Angeles to give a series of talks about his upcoming and very controversial Poor People's Campaign. And something he said must have set Ray off because he's only a few miles away in his hotel. And he goes to his hotel and says he's leaving tomorrow morning, puts in an order for a change of address form to Atlanta, Georgia.
So he moves from this is James Earl Ray moves from California to Atlanta, Georgia. It's a big move, right?
It's a big move, and it's not a city that he has any known connection to or any friends. But here he is moving to King's hometown.
So James Earl Ray is in California, then moves to the Deep South only weeks before the assassination of Martin Luther King would occur. Let's talk a little bit about Martin Luther King and where he was. What generally was his frame of mind in these final weeks of his life?
This is a very different Martin Luther King than I think most of us are familiar with. He had been getting death threats for really his whole career, but in those last few weeks and months, he was getting more of them, and the whole thing was intensifying. He had developed enemies and lost a lot of his allies in Washington because of his criticism of the Vietnam War. And it felt like he was in danger of being outflanked by the Black Power movement. He was not sleeping very well. He was smoking. He was eating too much and gaining weight. His marriage with Coretta was unraveling. It was a very dark and very intense and desperate time for him. And he had just hatched this very controversial Poor People's Campaign, which was essentially the idea was to build an enormous shanty town on the Mall in Washington, bring the poor people of all over the country, not just African Americans, but American Indians and people from Appalachia, from all walks of life, to Washington to stage this sort of protest at the feet of Capitol Hill to protest the conditions in the ghettos and systemic multi-generational poverty. It was a very, very controversial and heavily criticized phase of the movement. King had essentially decided to shift his focus from civil rights to economic justice. And so this is kind of where he was at when he got the phone call to come to Memphis to represent the garbage workers who had gone on strike.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that. Explain just a little bit about this sanitation workers' strike and why it brought Martin Luther King to Memphis and what sort of challenges that posed for him and his movement.
Mm-hmm. His advisors thought that coming to Memphis was a real mistake. That was quite a kind of left turn for him to be making. That he should be focused on this thing in Washington exclusively. But you know, he couldn't ignore what was happening in Memphis. These guys were striking for better wages and for better conditions after a horrible accident in which two garbage workers had been ground up in a faulty hydraulic truck mechanism. And when he came to Memphis, he decided he would lead a march down Beale Street, the historic avenue of the blues. And this was going to be it. He would leave Memphis. He would go back to Washington and start recruiting for this bigger cause that he was pushing for.
But the march really went very wrong, didn't it?
The march got taken over by black militants and high school students who were just out for a good time, and it turned violent, and there was looting and smashing of windows, and the cops descended on everyone, and it was really a nightmare for Martin Luther King, because his whole career, of course, was staked on nonviolence, and here he was appearing to be leading a violent march. So this set up kind of the third act, which was he realized he had to come back to Memphis yet again to lead another march that would be peaceful. And it was that third appearance in Memphis that got him killed.
Now according to the evidence that the FBI later developed, we know that James Earl Ray had a map with places in Atlanta where Martin Luther King might have been found. So it was clear he had an interest in his movements. Where did he go to finally get the perch from which he would fire the fatal shot?
Ray ended up checking into a flop house on South Main, which was directly across from the Lorraine Motel. He was shown a room that faced towards Main Street, which would be the other side of the building, and he immediately said, "No, thank you, I don't want that." And then he was shown a room on the back side that faced the Lorraine, and he immediately took that and paid a week's rent, which makes most of us think that he was thinking he'd be there a while, that he probably wasn't going to be doing an assassination from that room, that he was simply going to use that room as a perch to follow King's movements, thinking the lawyers are going to be working this out for weeks, for at least a days, up to a week, until they would actually get to do this march. So I don't think he thought the assassination would take place there.
As it happened, his opportunity came that very day. Now, did he actually have a shot at King from the room that he rented?
He did, but he would have had to have leaned out over the window and expose himself. The angle is less than ideal. The only way he could really get a direct shot was to go down to the communal bathroom, which was this filthy room, you know, down the hall, that had a direct shot if he stood in the bathtub. After the assassination, the police found that the window in the bathroom had been jerked up about 5 inches. The screen had been jimmied from its groove, and there was a palm print on the wall, and various people in the flophouse had heard a shot coming from that bathroom, so it became pretty clear that's where the shot came from.
So it appears that James Earl Ray took the rifle, which he had purchased recently, from his room down to the bathroom where he could get a clear look at King, who, as it turned out, was lingering on his balcony. You also note that he realized that he needed some binoculars to really follow his movements. He went out and bought those. When it came time to get a shot, it's interesting he loaded only a single round into the weapon.
Right.
How hard or easy a shot was this for a guy who obviously was not a trained marksman?
You know, I've stood on the balcony and I've stood in the flop house, which is now part of the National Civil Rights Museum. It's an easy shot. It's about 200 feet. With a 7-power scope, which is what he had, it would be appear to be about 30 feet. King's face would have almost completely filled the optical plane of the scope. He was not a trained or, you know, professional marksman, but he had been in the Army and had fired that very caliber of weapon. And I don't think, you know, in the end, you know, the shot itself was actually fairly easy.
King was lingering on the balcony with some friends because they were about to go out to dinner, and you write that he was in a jovial and relaxed mood when he was hit by this shot, which caught him on the jaw and did terrible damage. The police were actually watching from a perch very nearby. Why?
The Memphis police had been following King and his entourage everywhere, and also a local black power group called the Invaders, who were in negotiations with King. So they had two black policemen in this firehouse that happened to face the Lorraine, looking at events through a peephole. So, you know, there were people watching this from various vantage points. And, you know, when this shot rang out, these policemen all ran outside from the firehouse and ran towards Lorraine, trying to figure out, you know, which direction did the shot come from.
And the firehouse was literally next door to the boarding house that Ray was perched in?
It's across the street.
Okay.
It's about like 200, maybe 250 feet away.
It does seem remarkable that with the police in a firehouse very nearby, that James Earl Ray was able to fire this shot, which was heard by lots of people, and then slip away. How close did he come to getting caught then?
Within 30 seconds. He ran down the stairs. He took a left turn. He was running towards his car, which was the white Mustang that was parked on the street, when he saw some policemen who were gathered around that fire station. And he had to do a very impulsive thing. On one level, you could say this was a really stupid act. He ditched the weapon. Everything needed to solve that case was in that bundle with the weapon and various other belongings that he had there. But if he hadn't done that, he would have been caught immediately with the weapon in his arms. So, you know, he really he had to do that. He jumped in the car and took off, and there were several witnesses there who saw the white Mustang as it took off heading north on Main Street. So, you know, he came probably within 30 seconds of getting caught.
And because there were witnesses and because someone discovered the weapon stashed, I guess, in the vestibule of a little shop right away, the mm-hmm. police were able to get out a report very quickly that they were looking for a man in a white Mustang.
Within 2 minutes, the report was going out looking for, you know, a white male, well-dressed because he was wearing a suit, in a white Mustang heading north on Main Street. They found that bundle there, and that bundle had, you know, it had the weapon, it had the scope, it had the ammunition, it had the binoculars that he had just bought at York Arms, which was a local sporting goods store, and it had a number of interesting belongings, like, for example, a transistor radio that had Ray's prison number on it. It was a radio that he had bought at the state penitentiary in Missouri. They didn't know what the numbers meant yet, but it turned out to be his prison ID number, 416J. There was also a number of other articles, the local newspaper, which mentioned in it that King and his entourage were staying at the Lorraine, and a number of toiletry items that it turned out to have Ray's fingerprints on them.
Well, for 2 months, he managed to evade the FBI, which despite Hoover's antipathy for King, was actively investigating this, throwing all of the resources they could into it. He finds his way to Canada, takes the bus up to Canada because border crossings were easy there. And then he figured out how to get a passport and airline ticket out of the country. And some conspiracy theorists will say there's no way this small-time criminal could have figured this out. Tell us how he did it and what your assessment is.
Well, he says that he went to the local library, looked back through some old issues of the Toronto newspapers and found some birth notices. And on the basis of those names from people born about the same year that he was born, he applied for a birth certificate. And the authorities in Ottawa gave him the birth certificate. And then on the basis of having the birth certificate, he applied for a passport. And they gave him a passport. The saying in Canada was, welcome to Canada. We trust you. It was unbelievably easy to get a passport to leave the country at that time. All you had to do really is say you were the person you said you were. That was good. That was good enough. There was no the paperwork was just unbelievably easy. And I think Ray himself was surprised at how easy it was. So getting the passport actually proved – it took a few weeks, but it really was very low tech and very inexpensive and not complicated at all.
And he had a new alias now.
During this whole period, he's been changing aliases. He went from being Galt to when he bought the gun, his name was Harvey Lohmeyer. And then when he checked into that flop house in Memphis, his name was John Willard. He came back to Atlanta, ditched the car, took the bus up to Toronto, and became very quickly Paul Bridgman and then Raymond George Snaid. And that's the name, Snaid, that he traveled on to London and on to Lisbon and then back to London briefly where he was caught.
James Earl Ray, after being captured in London, was extradited to the United States. He confessed and was sentenced to life in prison. He later recanted his confession and spent years talking about all this, wrote two books, gave interviews to Playboy and other media, and told stories that there was another guy, probably the gunman, somebody named Raoul. And this got some currency with members of the Martin Luther King family. His son Dexter King took up the cause and believed that James Earl Ray deserved a new trial. What do you make of what Ray said about this?
It's very difficult to understand his whole story. You know, after the plea bargain, he said, "All right, here's the real story. Yep, it's true. I bought the gun. I bought the scope. I bought the ammunition. I did come to Memphis just before the assassination and checked into that flop house. That was me. I did go down to York Arms to buy that set of binoculars 1-2 hours before the assassination. Yep, that was me. I did come back to the flop house, and I did leave the scene of the crime 1 minute after the assassination in the getaway car that everyone saw there on South Main. That was all me, and I did go to Atlanta and ditch the car and go on this long getaway to Toronto and London and all that. But there was just, you know, there was just this other guy named Raoul who actually pulled the trigger. That was his defense. And, you know, it's like, well, all right, who was Raoul? Do we have a photograph? Or do we have an address? Do we have a single witness who ever saw Ray in the same room with this guy? No, we don't have a physical description that's consistent. We don't have any information about this guy. And so naturally, a lot of people began to suspect that Raoul was just another alias that he made up in a lifelong career of making up aliases. I came to the conclusion that Raoul did not exist and that he was a figment of Ray's imagination, maybe kind of like his imaginary friend who, in fact, maybe did tell him to do these things. But the idea turned on the notion that Raoul was dictating his movements for the whole year that he was on the lam. And, you know, that it presupposes that Ray was trusting enough and was that stupid, essentially, to follow orders from a person he didn't even know. Ray had spent his whole career being, you know, very cagey and very cautious, didn't trust anyone, not even his own brothers, really. And yet, supposedly, he trusted this guy, Raoul, with his life. But nonetheless, I think it is a testament to Ray's craftiness that he was able to convince members of the inner circle, members of the King family, that that he was innocent, that this guy, Raoul, existed. It was kind of the final act of craftiness on his part, that he was able to convince people close to King that he was not only innocent, but, you know, this whole fiction of Raoul might have been true.
You don't discount the notion that he might have had, if not an accomplice, at least some financial support. I mean, there was a St. Louis segregationist named John Sutherland who was said to have offered a $50,000 bounty on the life of Martin Luther King. How do you assess mm-hmm. these notions?
Well, I think it's quite possible that he knew about that bounty. It's not clear that he was actually paid because he robbed a bank in London. He tried to rob a jewelry store. I don't think he would have exposed himself like that if he wasn't desperate for money. But in the end, I guess I am a conspiracist in the sense that I believe that there's ample evidence that he had some help along the way. Not this shadowy, esoteric, super sophisticated conspiracy, but a rather crude one. A handful of individuals, maybe some members of his family, maybe some criminal lowlives that he associated with. But along the path, there are plenty of unanswered questions about money and about some of his movements. He spent some time in New Orleans, for example, shortly before the assassination. What was he doing there? It's not clear. How exactly did he gather all those aliases? Was it just the way he said, where he went to the library and got the names out of back issues of the newspaper? Or was it something slightly more complicated? There are a lot of questions like that.
This is a fascinating account of Ray and his movements. And what I'm struck by at the end of the book is, in some ways, what a small guy he seemed. I mean, I'm reminded of the Hannah Arendt observation of the banality of evil. And I'm just wondering, do you feel like you understand him? Is he like Travis Bickle in Taxi Driver, some tortured soul, or like Timothy McVeigh, a young man who's ideologically driven? Do you feel like you get him?
I get parts of him. You know, I think that there wasn't a single motivation so much as, you know, kind of an amalgam of sub-motivations that he kind of threw into a blender and stuck it on puree. You know, like, yes, he was a person who thought of himself as a businessman and as a hustler, and possible that this was, you know, the ultimate business deal. Yes, he was a racist. Yes, he had a history of mental illness accentuated by years of amphetamine use. Throw all those sort of sub-motivations into this blender, and I think you begin to get some sense of how he could have done this and why he could have done this. But in the end, you're right. It's really about the banality of evil. It's about how a very hollow person can bring down a great man. And unfortunately, we've got a long and sordid history of people like that in this country, you know, from Timothy McVeigh to John Hinckley or people who have tried to bring down great men or people who have tried to express themselves, taking aim at history. Unfortunately, we have a long list of guys like that.
Well, Hampton Sides, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Hampton Sides spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. James Earl Ray died in prison in 1998. Sides' new book about Ray is called Hellhound on His Trail, The Stalking of Martin Luther King Jr. and the International Hunt for His Assassin. You can read a chapter on our website, freshair.npr.org. I hadn't heard the singer Stephanie Nakassian until the release of her latest CD, Billy Remembered, a tribute to Billie Holiday. I liked it so much, we invited Nakassian on the show. The album features songs Holiday recorded in the mid-1930s, like These Foolish Things, I Cried for You, I Wished on the Moon, and What a Little Moonlight Can Do. Nakassian paid tribute to singer June Christie on her album Lullaby and Rhythm. Stephanie Nakassian teaches jazz voice and vocal jazz improvisation at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia, and is the author of an instructional book on jazz singing called It's Not on the Page. She's performed several times on the public radio series Riverwalk Jazz. On her new album, Billy Remembered, her husband, Hot O'Brien, is featured on piano. Let's start with the opening track, No Regrets.
No regrets, although our love affair has gone astray. No regrets, I know I'll always care, though your way. Somehow our happy romance ended suddenly. Still in my heart you'll be forever mine. No
Stephanie Nakassian from her new CD, Billy Remembered, the classic songs of Billie Holiday. Stephanie Nakassian, welcome to Fresh Air. Listening closely to Billie Holiday from the mid-1930s in preparation for your CD, what did you really pick up on from her singing? And feel free to demonstrate that for us, to illustrate that for us.
Well, in the beginning, I tried to actually do what she was doing, and she sings very much from the throat, which is not really that safe. So if I really did I remember? It kind of felt like I was straining my voice. So I didn't really want to be too harsh with it. I wanted to protect my voice and not sing harshly. So I tried to get that soulful and immediate feeling without contriving it and without hurting myself. So I kind of did I remember? You know, try to be in the middle somewhere and get the essence of the feeling and the passion without making it sound corny or phony.
Well, I want to play another track from your Billie Holiday CD. So I think I'll go with I Wished on the Moon. Tell me what you like about this song.
I love this middle tempo feeling, this how relaxed it is and how gently moving it is. And it's a very hard tempo to get young singers to, or an instrumentalist for that matter, to get. It's easier to do really fast and really slow, and bossa nova is not too bad, although our phrasing is difficult in America to get the Latin feeling. But Wished on the Moon is that really nice, wished on the moon, dun, 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 and you kind of have to feel this gentle pulsing behind you. I always tell my students, kind of like the squid, the way the squid moves, it kind of propels itself through the water gently. She has this gentle propulsion.
Okay, so this is my guest, Stephanie Nakassian. And I should say, you know, one of the things that makes this CD so enjoyable is the musicians on it. I mean, you sound great, and you have great musicians on it, including your husband, Hod O'Brien, at the piano, Randy Sankey on trumpet, Harry Allen on tenor saxophone, Marty Gross on guitar. So this is Stephanie Nakassian singing I Wished on the Moon from her new CD, Billie Remembered, the Classic Songs of Billie Holiday.
I wished on the moon for something I never knew. I wished on the moon for more than I ever knew. Sweet a rose, a softer sky on an April day. That would not of a star to throw me a beam or two. Wished on the star and asked for a dream or two. I look for every loveliness, it all came true. I wished on the moon.
That's Stephanie Nakassian from her new CD, Billie Remembered, the Classic Songs of Billie Holiday. You've also done songs paying tribute to June Christie, performing mm-hmm. songs that she did, and mm-hmm. to Lee Wiley, performing songs that Lee Wiley did. And then you have an album called Thrush Hour, in which you sing in the manner of Bessie Smith, Ethel Waters, Sarah Vaughan, Abby Lincoln. Are you a mimic? I mean, can you do other people's voices? I'm not, you know.
I'd rather not be thought of as a mimic because that's not the goal. The
no,
goal
I realize that. But are you capable of doing that? Are you capable of being
a
mimic?
Oh, yeah. Sure. You really want to hear it? No, not really.
No. Show me what you can do.
No, I mean, if you do the Sarah Vaughan and you take it to, I mean, she actually mimicked herself in her later years, too. But, you know, if you do.
I agree
with you. I mean, you could really kind of mimic it to the point where it's almost kind of comedic. And I really respect these women and these artists so much. The point was to really infuse my own voice with the great foundation people, whether it's Louis Armstrong or Coleman Hawkins or Ben Webster or any of these ladies, great ladies of jazz.
What did you learn from the couple of years you spent on the road with John Hendricks, who is most famous, I think, as a former member of Lambert Hendricks and Ross, the vocal group?
Oh, so much. He just standing next to him singing Jumpin' at the Woodside my first week with him, my job was just to go jump, 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 jump. And in the beginning, I said, this is ridiculous. This is one note. And then I finally realized I'm really learning how to place the rhythm in these nice punctuated kind of, I call them flick, like flicking a note without it being harsh and heavy. And I just stood next to him and sang that line with him. And in doing that, I kind of got it. And so he taught by example. And also taught me to be more like a horn.
What does that mean?
Well, when John sings, it's wee ba doo boo doo. No, not a little. There's all these like bends, as you were saying with Billie Holiday. You know, It's not da 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 da. It's a you know, there's a lot of bends and turns the way a saxophone or a trumpet or a trombone would do. And so just by singing with him, I think I became more like a horn, as if I was on the road with a big band.
Was it comfortable, too, to start off on stage as more of a backup singer than being out there on your own?
Oh, it was a great apprenticeship. It's the perfect way to do it. Matter of fact, all the great singers started off in the bands. So they had their little script that they were supposed to do. And while they were on the road, you know, 100 days a year or more, they would be listening to the riffs of the band, and they'd be listening to the bass, and they'd be listening. So they'd hear these, they'd hear the little shakes and the little fall-offs and the way the horns are. And so they became horns. And I think that that's kind of missing these days because we don't have as much opportunity to be, you know, be band singers.
The only thing I object to about the idea of a singer should be like a horn is that a singer has a gift that instrumentalists don't have, which is language, words, lyrics. And I think the lyrics are so important when you sing to really kind of communicate the feeling of the lyric, the meaning of the mm-hmm. words, the sound of the words, which you do.
Yeah, I agree.
So
I agree. Thank you. Thank you. I think it's a juggling game between the lyric and the music always, and rhythm. And what the horn feeling allows you to do is to bend a note once in a while. So on the piano, it would be just a note, bop, you know. And once you're allowed to bend it a little bit, you can have all these. Of course, the bending of the notes that the horns did was really emulating the singer, because the singer in the blues would always bend the notes. So, you know, Louis Armstrong was listening to opera music. And so I really think it came from the singer first and then through the instrumentalist and then back to the singer again. But I agree with you. It's really about what do the words bring out in your feelings and then how can you best express those.
After leaving Wall Street, you decided to take some singing lessons.
Well, I started singing first, and then I realized I should take singing lessons. I had I started getting work, and there was about an 8 or 9 month period when I was trying to trade futures on the futures exchange, and I was trying to hang out until 3 in the morning, and that was definitely not working. And I had to decide between the two for a while. So I decided to try it for 5 years and really devote my life to learning about the music and studying and learning the solos and learning the instrumentalists. And then if after 5 years no one's hiring me and it really isn't happening, I go back to my business career, which I enjoyed and it was fun and I was successful with. I just, you know, it was very hard to try to split them and do both.
So when you decided to learn more about singing and take singing lessons, what are some of the things you learned about your voice that you didn't know before, and how to use your voice?
Well, I had a wonderful teacher. I was really skeptical about taking voice lessons because I'd seen a lot of singers who got very wrapped up in the technical aspect and got kind of uptight about it, and I didn't want any of that technical inhibition. So I found a wonderful teacher in New York, Joe Scott, who's not around anymore, but he was so inspirational, and he taught everybody from the Roaches rock group to soap opera stars to opera singers to, you know, he was wonderful. And he basically was like a guru almost to me. He would just encourage me to free up my voice and keep connected with vowels and opening the throat and relaxing, and didn't put a lot of ideas in my head about how to do it. It was much more about staying open and relaxed so that I could sing and not getting in the way.
What was the key for you in learning how to really relax your throat and sing openly?
The visualization I use for my students, and this is coming free of charge, is you drop your jaw, and that opens your, that's what all choir teachers tell their students, you drop your jaw nice and relaxed, and then you have to open the back gate, which is your yawn. When you yawn, your tongue goes down, and the tongue has to go down in order for the throat to be open. So when those gates are open, usually the voice comes flying out. You don't really have to push it out. When it gets tight in the jaw, when the tongue comes pulling up like it does in some, you know, some of the R&B music is very dangerous because they sing, eh, baby, you know, the tongue comes up. So we try to watch that tongue. It's the strongest set of muscles in the body, so we have to be careful with the tongue. But it should lie down. And when you think of a yawn, even if you just visualize it, the body kind of responds. So visualization works really well.
Of course, you don't speak while you're yawning, so it's almost counterintuitive because nothing else happens when you yawn.
Well, we practice on ah. Ah. You practice with that so you can feel how open and free and great that is. Then we try other vowels with the same openness. And then you sneak those consonants in, which we need for enunciation and for rhythm. And we try not to disturb that beautiful, open, flowing nature of the voice. So it's a juggling act between the consonants, which are in the front, and the, you know, the open throat. But every singer has to have that open throat. Otherwise, you start grabbing, and it's dangerous.
Is it sometimes challenging to maintain a relaxed style of singing and a relaxed throat when you're really nervous about the concert you're about to give?
Of course. Life is not relaxed. When I say to my students, oh, you must just relax and let go and don't think so hard and don't try so hard, you know, they're like, you know, they're like, what is this? I have to, you know, I have to do my emails and I have to do my BlackBerry and I have to, you know, it's not part of our way of being. So we have to work on that. So I know I have to work on breathing and relaxing and trusting that it's going to be okay. Now, there is an element of tension that's very good for a performance. I'll never forget, I had one performance where I actually felt very relaxed and cool, and I didn't really do a very good job. So you have to have a little bit of up feeling, adrenaline to get you through. On the other hand, if it's tight, just like an athlete, I do a lot of comparisons to athletes, you can't exercise on tight muscles. You get wounded, you get injured. And that's basically what the voice is. It's a bunch of muscles.
Everything that we've played has been you paying tribute to another singer. So I thought I'd play a song in which you're just not paying tribute to anybody else. You're just being you. And this is from a recent album. It's from last year. The album's called If I Ruled the World. And the song I want to play is Too Many Tears. It's a Harry Warren, Al Dubin song. And why don't you say a few words about being yourself on this completely and also about why you chose the song?
Well, I appreciate you playing that because I don't want to be known as a tribute singer. I think that's just something, as I said, it really came out of my being a teacher more than anything. But I've done many CDs that I felt the songs were unusual. I didn't want to do necessarily standards, although I did do one recording in Japan that was all standards that I turned out to be enjoyable to me. I thought I would not enjoy it as much, but it was great. And I wanted to find songs that were passionate because that's what it's all about. And this song is bluesy and deep and has those bending moments and just kind of spoke to me at that point.
Well, that's quite good. Stephanie Nakassian, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Too many tears. Each night I go to bed, I lie awake and shed too many tears. Your memory is bringing me too many tears. Too many years.
Stephanie Nakassian's latest album is a tribute to Billie Holiday called Billie Remembered. If you wish you could sing a Billie Holiday song with a band as good as Nakassian's, you're in luck. She recorded a Music Minus One version of her album, which features the original tracks with her singing, followed by just the instrumental tracks so that you can provide the vocal. On our website, you can hear her sing No Regrets, then play the instrumental version and sing along. That's at freshair.npr.org.